This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, January 13th, 2010. I'm Caleb Brown. Credit ratings, the assignment of letter grades to debt and stock issued by private firms and governments, played a key role in the financial crisis. But why? Mark Calabria, Director of Financial Regulation Studies at the Cato Institute, says the rating agencies have long been nothing more than a government cartel.
Well, for well over 100 years, credit rating agencies have been what we call a gatekeeper in terms of the ability of investors to hold certain assets. Now, they hold a variety of roles depending on the entity. For instance, bank capital standards are set based on ratings. You get the better the rating, the less capital you have to hold against it. A lot of large institutional investors, whether it's pension funds, money market mutual funds, many of these entities are restricted by law from only holding investment grade rating. So it really is the case that the rating agencies kind of get to decide who gets to hold what for many of the largest investors in our economy. And so for it to be investment grade, someone, of course, has to decide that it's investment grade. And of course, you can't decide that yourself as the investor. You know, this outside agency, the credit rating agencies, have to do so. Now, in the mid-70s, there was a concern that, you know, investors would just decide, well, you know, I'll just hire whoever to tell me what I have is investment grade. So there's SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, set up a process where they could essentially try to prevent, in their mind, a race to the bottom where rating agencies were simply just for sale. And so at that point, up until the 70s, it was essentially the investor that paid for the ratings. And you would actually have – I mean, this really started out back in the 1880s, 1890s, when you started – where the ratings were all about railroad bonds, and there were large books that were published that would tell you the quality of the railroad bonds. And these all these books were sold to the investor. So if you were thinking about investing in something, you might pay, you know, rating agency, or you might buy the individual rating.
So that changed in the mid-1970s, that the payments then came from – the issuer of the bond.
We really have seen a shift since the 70s, and this was something that was slowly working its way for a variety of reasons. But the 70s really marked a turning point to where the rating agencies were predominantly issuer investor pays to now it is predominantly, not exclusively, there are a handful of agencies that operate an issuer pays model, but they're quite small compared to the overall part of the market, where for right now, the issuer pays. So if I'm going to sell a security, I would pay a rating agency to rate that security. And that way, you know, this is where the concerns about the conflict of interest come about, that the issuer is only going to pay if it's a good rating. I mean, why would I pay for a bad rating? But that sort of shift of control from the issuer pays to rather from the investor pays to the issuer pays is really something that has raised a lot of questions and concerns in terms of, you know, can you really trust the rating agencies and what are the incentives that they face?
Mortgage-backed securities, which became very popular in the 2000s, originated for the most part in the 90s, but are very complicated. Individual banks might have a difficult time having somebody in-house actually evaluate the quality of the credit in one of these things, which is, in the case of mortgages, is dozens or hundreds of mortgages chopped up and divided up into tranches. The first tranche takes all the losses, and then the second tranche takes all the losses, and then the people who have that last tranche are presumably in a better credit situation than the other two. And so credit ratings played an instrumental role in determining the quality of those assets for banks and other investors.
They really did. The market for mortgage-backed securities really started from a combination of Freddie and Fannie and the Office of Thrift Supervision. For instance, a lot of the assets that came out of the savings and loan crisis were securitized by the government. And because it essentially had the government guarantee, just as Freddie and Fannie, MBS have a guarantee, there was not really a lot of effort to look beyond. You didn't have to structure this with the tranches where somebody else would take the first loss. You would just have, here's a mortgage-backed security, it's full of mortgages, and don't really worry about the credit risk. I mean, of course, there'd be prepayment risk and there's interest rate risk in it, but you wouldn't have to worry about the credit risk because the government has it at some point. And once you had those markets start to develop and develop in other areas as well, I mean, we have a very active and large market in credit card receivables and other things that are securitized. But once other market participants start to come in, it really became, you know, I no longer have a government guarantee. I mean, how do I know that this is safe? And the way that the market got at this was to tranche it where somebody else would take the first loss. For instance, in most of these AAA mortgage-backed securities, you'd have to see 7, 8, 10% of the entire pool of mortgages go bad before the AAA would take a loss. And so a lot of it really was contingent on modeling of what were house prices going to do, what's the severity of loss. You know, I mean, do you lose 100% on the dollar in terms of the mortgage, which is, of course, not the case. But, you know, the argument of whether you lose 30 cents versus 50 cents really plays into how you slice up those tranches and how you can make some pieces AAA and make some pieces not.
So the sensitivity of the model played a role, but combine that with the fact that nobody projected the kinds of losses that housing actually took.
That's an important part to keep in mind, which is, yes, the AAA security ratings allowed a lot of investors to hold these instruments. But of course, for someone to hold the AAA piece also means somebody had to hold the equity piece or the double B piece. And somebody had to hold the junk because you couldn't just make – you can't make 95% of a mortgage-backed security. You know, the whole investment needs to be sold to somebody. And so there was a willingness certainly on the part of hedge funds held a lot of the equity pieces. The banks themselves hold a lot of the equity pieces. But for the models to work, you essentially have to get your assumptions, you know, largely correct, or you have to do some sensitivity analysis on it. And this is one of one of the many failures of the rating agencies was, is their assumptions were simply, you know, it's easy to say ex post ridiculous. I mean, for instance, the usual assumption was that house prices would never decline more than 5%, and even that was only like a 5% chance of happening. So most of these models were assuming either a flattening of house prices, so that you got not a fall but just a flattening, and that the severity rates – and this is one of the things we've seen quite different in this real estate cycle – is the loss per loan. I mean, it's important to keep in mind there are two factors here. One is whether the person pays the mortgage or not and the loan goes bad. The other fact of it is, if the loan does go bad, how much more do you get out of it? And we've seen the usual assumption of, say, 20, 30% loss on a loan actually go closer to about 50%. So some of this is that, and of course, that's contingent on this length and the death of the housing market decline, too. So a lot of these variables interacted together. And the rating agencies were largely taking a consensus viewpoint. You certainly didn't have the government, whether it was CBO, OMB, or anybody else, come out and say we're going to see a 30% decline in prices. There were a few Cassandras out there. It's certainly worth saying. But for the most part, the consensus outlook was, you know, the housing market was going to cool at some point, but it wasn't going to drop off a cliff. And that, I think, was the primary assumption that really led the market, the credit rating agencies, astray.
You said the credit rating agencies essentially took a consensus view, but that's one of the criticisms of credit rating agencies. Lehman Brothers lost 95% of its share value before its debt was downgraded.
And that's really part of the problem with the rating agencies, and I think the regulatory structure and the market structure we have now, which is the incentive for the rating agencies is not to really take a lot of risk. They're a gatekeeper. Arguably, what they do is simply sell a license. And if they get it right, I mean, the way that they can best protect their reputation is if you believe that the market consensus is right most of the time and you simply reflect the market consensus most of the time, you'll be right most of the time. And it really is a strategy where the rating agencies could essentially protect their reputation by wrapping themselves up in what is largely the consensus. This is one of the reasons that I have considerable concern about some of the suggestions to fix rating agencies along the lines of suing the rating agencies.
Or making them legally liable for their ratings.
So if you make the rating agencies legally liable for their ratings, what you should think about is, okay, if you're a rating agency and you're in court and you're being sued, what is the best way to protect yourself from losing that suit is if you have taken a reasonable man approach to the assumptions. And so if you take the consensus assumptions, it's pretty defensible in the courtroom to go there and say, well, I presented the same assumptions that everybody else presented. You're much more likely to lose a suit if you're the outlier. And I think this is one of the problems about our structure of our rating agencies now is what you actually want to do is encourage contrarians, encourage outliers, encourage someone to question the status quo. I mean, anybody could simply just look at the newspaper and see what the markets are doing that day to get the status quo. You don't really need to pay somebody millions of dollars to just reiterate to you what the status quo is. But the way the incentives in the system are set up today is it really does push the rating agencies to essentially reiterate the status quo, right, the consensus viewpoint.
Multiple ratings on securities can help assure market participants of its value, which goes directly to this consensus view idea that if it's part of the official regulatory structure, if they're selling licenses, if they could be held legally liable for the things that they're saying, it definitely discourages the second rating from really having any value.
It does, but we've actually seen in the marketplace. I mean, for instance, it's been recognized for a while that, for instance, Moody's was more conservative than S&P, even on the same securities. And while most of the time they rated the same security given the same rating, you did see differences. You did see some more aggressiveness. But that said, I mean, clearly you had a pseudo oligopoly here that encouraged essentially all the ratings to be, you know, a little less than aggressive and a little behind the curve. There were differences in terms of who was further behind the curve is one way of looking at it. And there certainly was some incentive for rating agencies to develop a better reputation because arguably the fight between, say, a Moody's and S&P wasn't necessarily over growing their market, even though the market was growing, but the fight was between market share. And this can take over a lot of forms. One form it could be is reducing the quality of the ratings to get more issuer pays. The other form would be to try to retain yourself as a larger reputation for those investors who actually did care about what the rating said.
But in the run-up to the financial crisis, relatively fewer groups cared enough about the quality of the rating. They were saying they, in large part, thought, "Well, investment grade. I have delegated." Some of my due diligence to this third party. The government has delegated some of its regulatory authority to this third party. So it becomes that much more important that they get these things right.
And that's absolutely correct. I mean, one of the problems, and I would characterize the financial crisis, one of the drivers of the financial crisis was really a massive reduction on the part of due diligence by investors, by borrowers, by lenders, by the government, you know, by the regulators. And so you really had this incentive system where everybody could essentially say, well, I've got this rating on it. My job is done. And that really led to a lot of lax behavior on a lot of parts of market participants. And of course, because the rating agencies were subject to incentives to essentially reflect a consensus viewpoint, they weren't challenging that either. So you really had an essentially a system where somebody could always point to somebody else and say, what was their job? And they did it, and that's covered me. And this is an important limitation to keep in mind about going back, as some have argued, to an investor pays model, which is if you're an investor, you hold a whole lot of security. I mean, it's nice to get an accurate rating on the way in, but if you hold a whole lot of security and the rating agencies downgrade it, that's a massive loss to your wealth holdings. So there are incentives actually for investors to say, well, you know, I don't want you to quite downgrade this quite yet. So, you know, there are clearly, you know, perverse incentives either way. And so ultimately what one needs to set up is a system where there's less dependence both by regulators and investors on the rating agencies so that these parties end up doing more due diligence on their own.
Including the regulators.
Particularly the regulators. And this is an incredibly important part is that when the bank regulators go in and decide how much capital you hold against an asset, one of the primary things they do is what's the rating on this asset? And it's often – that's where it stops. I'll look and say this loan is AAA. This is the capital you have to hold. And me as the bank examiner does not look any further beyond that. And this is a real problem with the bank regulation. And of course, you also provide an incentive because it's important to keep in mind that capital standards aren't just simply absolute levels. They're relative levels. And so the better rated it is, the lower capital you would hold. Well, because two types of assets, mortgage related and sovereign debt, were generally AAA related and you could hold very little capital against them, we had a bank capital system that encouraged banks to overweigh themselves both in sovereign debt and in mortgage related assets. And I think it's no coincidence that those are the two sectors that have caused the most problems.
On the compensation model, who pays for the ratings, that would seem to be irrelevant if we lived in a world where the government were not in charge of deciding how much capital banks had to hold. Who paid for it would seem pretty irrelevant at that point.
It would be irrelevant. I think you could have both an issuer and investor pays model that if there were choice and competition, both of those could work. Because even on the issuer paid model, if you were going to buy a rating that was meaningless, that everybody in the market participants knew that, well, this person will tell you whatever, then that should be reflected in the debt price. You should get no savings for what you sell that debt for. Whereas if you or the issuer go out and you buy the reputation, that should be reflected. And this is my point even with, as I said earlier, you saw more conservative ratings issued by Moody's, and you saw differences in debt costs reflect those differences in ratings. So even from the investor pays perspective, the incentive is to actually get the best reputation because that will lower your funding costs. Because it's important to keep in mind the cost of the rating itself is a rounding error compared to what you may or may not have to pay in terms of higher funding costs for your debt, depending on the rating of it. So there are – but the point is that the incentives are there. Now, the disincentives, the perverse incentives that are in the current system is that the investors themselves don't have to care as long as it's AAA. So if you want to change anybody's investors – anybody's incentives in this process, it really has to be the investors' incentives.
Mark Calabria is Director of Financial Regulation Studies at the Cato Institute. Read more on credit rating agencies at cato.org.